everyone. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette. I'm your host, Bridget Keys, and I'm joined today by two Murder, She Wrote aficionados and talented writers. Alicia Schaefer teaches writing at the University of Michigan Dearborn. She's also worked in corporate communication, literary publishing, and film production and development. Alicia has seen every episode of Murder, She Wrote twice and has fond memories of watching on the couch with her mom when the series first aired and then re-watching on Netflix when she was in grad school, which is also what I did. That's how I wrote my dissertation. Alicia holds an MFA in writing from Sarah Lawrence College and has had her short fiction and nonfiction writing published in journals and online. And more importantly, her cell phone's ringtone is the Murder, She Wrote theme song. Alicia, welcome to the Cabot Cove Gazette.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Mark Benedict, who is a graduate of the MFA writing program, also at Sarah Lawrence College. And his publications include short stories, author interviews, and book and movie reviews. And before meeting Alicia, he had never seen an episode of Murder, She Wrote. But of course, now look at him co-hosting the Cabot Cove Gazette.
Look at me now.
Yeah. Look at you now, baby. And his favorite authors include Stephen King and Karen Russell, and we assume also J.B. Fletcher. Mark Benedict, welcome to the Cabot Cove Gazette.
Thanks for having me.
We are talking today about season 4, episode 8, Steal Me a Story. Mark, why don't you get us started reminding us what this episode's about?
All right. Jessica gets involved with a TV crime show because the young producer of the show tries to steal the plot of her latest book for an episode. And that's what I've got to start us off. I think someone else is going to have to hop in and take it from there.
So I think this reminds me already a lot of Hooray for Homicide, that we see her back in Hollywood and Hollywood is doing something with her work once again, trying to turn it into something for the screen. But this time she's not participating in it. Like they haven't bought the rights or anything. They're just trying to plagiarize. And I think, you know, as Jessica tries to find out what's going on and stop this from happening, we learn that there's this sort of shady producer guy who's the one who ends up getting murdered. And I think that the episode is just so full of like producers and executives that it's kind of head spinning to keep track of who's who. Did you guys have that problem too?
Yes. There were a lot of characters, and a lot of clues to kind of pick up on, you know, who's saying what and who are they talking about, because they would refer to each other by name. And sometimes it was hard to remember who that person exactly is. So there were a lot of people and a lot of people who had similar jobs on set or unclear jobs on set. But it was a little bit confusing just to parse that out.
It strikes me that you referred to the shady producer. Like they're all shady like that, you know. We need a different descriptor. I think of him as the young shady producer, because there's another shady producer, of course, who's older.
Wait, now I'm so curious, between Bradford Dillman and Ken Swilford, who are like both long, you know, like frequent Murder, She Wrote guest stars and 80s TV guest stars, and they're both in this episode as producers. Who do you think is older?
Oh, okay. I'm thinking of the guy who collaborates with Gail. I'm thinking of him. I feel like he was referred to as a producer.
He was.
He seemed okay. So he's the younger guy, and the older guy is Sharky.
Yeah. So Bradford Dillman plays Stone, who is like hiring the young woman to write and is trying to convince her to just rip off J.B. Fletcher's latest book. But she, of course, has a conscience. So what she does, what all aspiring Hollywood writers would do, she hunts down J.B. Fletcher to tell her what's going on, which I guess actually works out for her career, because in the end, like now she has like this best-selling world famous novelist as a friend.
That's true. That's true.
That's not always enough, though, Bridget. Like I can say that's, you know, but I think it's great. And that's one thing I like about that relationship, is that Jessica's there for her and she's going to help her in any way that she can.
That's definitely a theme we see with Jessica over and over, is that she's always willing to help aspiring writers. And then what I think is interesting is that she always tells them that she'll read their pages when they have pages to read, which seems like her attorney probably would not actually let her do in real life, right?
Or just the amount of time that might take. I mean, I've been in that position where I've offered, to read somebody's work and then I get it and I'm like, oh gosh, okay. I need to set aside a weekend for this. So I don't tell nearly as many people as Jessica Fletcher does. I
Do
can't
you also
imagine.
give them $150,000 or $250,000 to go like as a start their writing career? Do you, that's a reference to We're Off to Kill the Wizard. That was one of TJ's like favorite things to call back to, was like just the ridiculousness that not only will she like take time to read these amateur writers' work, but also like give them money to make their careers happen. Which seems even more implausible than reading their pages, but
And yes, very much so. But what I found sort of a little bit as kind and willing to help as Jessica Fletcher normally is, I was surprised how much she was willing to give to the TV show, because sort of their plan with Gail is to work together to rewrite a script for the TV show, but Jessica's not asking for any credit. She's not getting paid for this. And so as much as she's helping Gail, which is great, she's also giving a really big service to the program, which they don't necessarily deserve at all.
yeah, for sure. And then the interesting part is like, so of course, Gail comes back to Stone with this like great story plot. And she's like, we should do this instead of plagiarizing. And he's like, nah. And then when she's like, well, Mrs. Fletcher helped me write it, like Mrs. Fletcher said you would reject it. He's like, wait, what? Oh, now I want this story, right? Like now it has some big name attached to it. It must be a good plot. She also, over the course of her investigation of who killed the other producer, Sid Sharkey, played by Ken Swofford, she also like decides to like sort of go undercover doing story development for the show, which is so weird. And I can't believe anybody believed she actually was there to do that job. Like, again, she's like a world famous novelist. Like, would your beloved Stephen King, maybe that's a bad example because Stephen King does a lot of media work, but I'm just thinking like, who is a world famous novelist that has time and like needs money badly enough that they're going to be like, yeah, I'm going to sit behind the desk at a TV office all day doing story development. Like, that just seems so weird to me.
Well, did it wasn't it wasn't the idea that she was just going to do that on a temporary basis just until this crime got solved?
Yeah, I mean, she's undercover, but I'm saying, like, why would anyone involved with the show think that she was serious, right?
Agreed. And then actually, but to get to back to the young producer guy, when what I remember when Gail told him that Jessica Fletcher actually essentially wrote the new episode, that he kind of freaked out on kind of a like a, from a litigation standpoint, where he's like, oh, you told her about, this other story idea that I had where I was going to steal it from her. I feel like he didn't really get like kind of, open to the idea of it actually being a legit episode that they could film until he like met up with Jessica Fletcher. And even then, that was like short-lived. But I don't know. I might have missed something, or like I didn't get the feeling that he really wanted to like roll with the new script just because like she's such a name or whatever.
I feel like it goes to a couple of things about this episode overall. Is one, obviously we need a lot of suspects, and I think Mark, as you said before, everybody's kind of bad. They're all sort of bad people, a lot of them in the episode. So we have a lot of possible murderers. But also, and I love the show in general, so I don't want to be like nitpicking at it, but the way Jessica inserts herself, into the world, at one point Stone even says to her, you have no concern or business being on the set or on the lot. And in that point, I mean, he's kind
He's
of right.
right.
He has not been hired yet by the actor to help develop stories, and she's really just running. I don't know how she's getting passes to get on the set, but she's really running around and helping everybody. And she has, an interest because she in this episode is a suspect. which doesn't always happen. But in this case, she has even a personal interest to get her name off of the suspect list.
Yeah, so after she learns about the plot, I mean, we see her going to the network executive directly. And what I like is that it's a woman executive, which is kind of rare at this point, probably still in Hollywood, at the television network UTN. And the woman is like, "Oh, I'm going to deal with that terrible producer. Just trust me." And Jessica's like, "Not buying that." So she goes to the producer's office directly, but he's not there. So she talks to his secretary, played by Fionnuala Flanagan, which is super cool. And they actually leave together. But later, somebody comes and leaves like this pink wrapping papered present on the producer's desk. He comes back in the office and is like, "What's this present for me?" Shakes it. It's a bomb. It blows up and he's dead. And so, because Jessica and the secretary were among the last to leave the office, it seems like they're probably suspects. And of course, the detective makes all these inferences like, because it was pink wrapping paper, it had to have been a woman who did it, right? So, yeah, so
Well,
Jessica has a personal motivation, as you say, Alicia, right? Like, she has to clear her own name as well as everybody else's.
did you catch that Sharky says, I think to the younger producer, that the younger producer has enough bombs on his resume to stock an arsenal? Which was funny because he says it like it's this stock phrase that everyone knows and that he's got always on the ready, like but it's even more funny because he ends up getting bombed. So that's interesting, and I liked that. That was pretty cool.
Some foreshadowing for us.
Yeah. Some dark foreshadowing, some kind of like gotcha foreshadowing.
So let's talk about some of the people. Alicia, you said there's like everyone, there's a lot of people, and it's hard to keep track of them, but also that they're sort of all portrayed as like not great people. And I think in part that's like Murder, She Wrote's representation of Hollywood, right? It's always like this sort of shady, seedy place where nobody's really happy. So we have the TV show that they're filming is a medical drama. The lead actor can't remember his lines and he's having money problems. But other than that, I mean, he sort of opens the episode, but other than that, he's not really important to it. Then we have the woman who plays his nurse, who's played by Lenore Kasdorf, who we last saw in Trial by Error, and we saw her before in It's a Dog's Life. We saw her in that one. And she is also really disgruntled. She has the opportunity for a movie deal, but her role on the TV show is getting in the way. And so it seems like she could have killed the producer because her contract is missing. And this could have been her moment to like get out of her contract with this TV show to go do a more lucrative movie. But it wasn't her. And we also have the secretary. Fionnuala Flanagan playing Frida, the secretary, who says she was supposed to be getting promotions and getting to be a producer, but the Sid Sharkey, our victim, always kept her as a secretary. And so she really didn't like him. So it seems like it could be her. And in fact, at one point, as part of a ruse to catch the actual murderer, we see her like pulling out a gun and being evil. And then we have, of course, all the producers. So the other producers, with the network executive, Kate Hollander, who didn't like the guy, and the other producer, the young one, as Mark says, Stone, played by Bradford Dillman, and then Gail, the young writer, is also somehow in the mix. So just a lot of people, and they're all really unhappy for people who have so much money. And then we have
Yeah,
like
that's true.
nice old Jessica in the middle here.
Well, I mean, when you said that it has a kind of a negative view of Hollywood, my surprise with like Murder, She Wrote in the episodes that I've seen, that it's kind of like everyone we see is sort of like unwholesome. Like I assumed it would be this cozy, wholesome show with mostly like, kind of smart, kind-hearted people. But here especially, it's just a sleazy, inept world. And I don't think it's just the TV industry. It's also the press, the police. Everyone's a bad person or bad at their job or both. So that's kind of, there wasn't really anyone I didn't want to get murdered except Gail. And that's kind of dark though too, because like in the end, like there's no space for her. and there's no job for her, and she just has to go off and, be an unpaid writer. And even though Jessica like has, said, "I'll read your, stuff," or whatever, this is such a corrupt place that like there's not like a slot that she can fit into, like, either in the TV industry or apparently anywhere else, I don't know. But based on what we see, this is like, she could make a lot of money. She says it outright at one point that she could make a lot, make her rent, I think, for, quite a long time from just this one assignment. And it's so like, it's such a foul, polluted world that she'd rather just like walk, and that's, I don't know. I don't know. It's kind of, it seems a little dark, even though it's like kind of Jessica is this like smart, kind-hearted person, like walking through, coming into this sewer kind of, and then it's like, but things are just going to be like, there's justice in the end, but after she leaves, it's just going to go back to being this like corrupt sewer. And if not for Jessica's like aid and help, Gail, is Gail going to find her way? Like, would she find her way? And even with Jessica's help, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I would, acknowledge that. I mean, in these shows, they need a lot of suspects. So they need to have some people who seem possibly, able to commit murder. So you have to have enough people like that, I guess. But Mark, to your point about this episode, I mean, I agree. And what I sort of find fascinating is how personal this episode is, not necessarily to, Angela Lansbury, but to Murder, She Wrote as a show, and how it's about a doctor who solves crimes in a cozy town. And then we're on the set of a TV show that's making this movie. And so we've got a lot of like players in this that, are actually making this TV show. We have representations of those people in the episode. And I think some things that came up were really interesting and still resonate today. Like a lot of the actors were saying how they felt underpaid.
Oh, yeah.
Writers, yeah, the
Yeah,
writers
yeah.
felt underpaid. They got Gail in there, who is a very capable, smart writer. But he, Stone makes it clear that she's hired because he has to hire a woman. And we've got this patriarchal system, that's resisting promoting or including women. And then to your point, Bridget, about the wrapping paper, Lieutenant Bradshaw even refers to it as pink feminine wrapping paper. And I just thought, why does it have to be feminine just because it's pink? Why do we have to go that extra step? And so I think the show is, obviously commenting on the ridiculousness of it. But then, sorry, one other point too was sort of TV versus movies. And that comes up a lot too. There's these references to like, well, we're just a measly TV show that nobody really cares about. As much as they care about like the big Hollywood movie directors. And so they joke like, calling the director John Huston or saying, we're not filming Citizen Kane here. And then even when Frida, who I think my two favorite characters in this episode are Frida and Gail. And so when Frida brings Jessica to her new office, it's a huge, beautiful office. And she's like, sorry, it's so small, but the movie people, they get the great space, and we get just these measly offices.
Which is amazing because it is a stunningly beautiful office, like well decorated and huge. But then she also makes the point that like a movie producer can lose $30 million and still have his fridge stocked with caviar, right? That's how Hollywood works. But if you lose money in TV, your show is axed and you're out of a job, right? So she's really calling attention to the differences between those industries, which I think is such a great point, Alicia. And it's reiterated at the end of the episode when the murder is solved, and we'll talk about who actually did it in a second. But when Jessica is about to leave the lot, we have the network executive, Kate Hollander, comes running up to her and is like, "I got a great idea for a series. Like, let's do the J.B. Fletcher Mystery Hour," which is, of course, a reference to Murder, She Wrote itself, right? And then Jessica's like, "Oh no, I don't write sex scenes or car chases, which are two things that Murder, She Wrote in its Bible said it would never do." And so it's just all making all of these sort of meta references. And she's like, "I don't think that show would be very successful." And of course, we have actual Murder, She Wrote being in the top 10 programs, right? So it's just making all these sort of cheeky references to how the industry works.
And it's a great opening. I think it's just one interrupted shot that opens it. It's like this layered reverse zoom opening. And it kind of plays with our vantage point. Our vantage point keeps expanding. At first, we think we're watching a doctor and a nurse, except no, it's actually a scene from a TV show. And it keeps revealing a little at a time until we see the full reality. And it's that we're actually in a screening room with a producer and a writer. And that's just that's a really smart economic opening. It introduces four characters in a really short space of time. And it also establishes the meta theme.
Yeah, so meta. It's such a great episode. And it's the way that it addresses, you know, how the industries work. And also just what a great episode to have two writers as the guest host, because this is all about writing. How is movie writing different from TV writing, different from being a novelist, you know? So we should talk about who actually did it and why. So we later learned that we have this whole plot to sort of trap the guy who is the director, the frequent director of the TV series within the TV series. And it involves Frida pretending she's gone bad and holding him and Jessica up at gunpoint and trying to shoo them into a car. And the guy's really scared, which means he knows that he already planted a bomb in that car. And so I love Mark speaking to the visuals. I love the moment when he panics and jumps out of the car and we have this low angle shot at these police lights and the police sort of slowly walking toward him menacingly, like, we have now caught you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
And the reason he killed Sid Sharkey, you guys, was what exactly? I mean, everyone's miserable, but...
My notes say motive is lame. Sorry. I thought the motive was lame. I mean, yeah, he had a sort of dark past, you know, before he got this gig as director on the show. And Sid Sharkey knows about that dark past of maybe drug use and possibly other things and, you know, kind of threatens to fire him and then expose him for that past so that he can't find work again.
Yeah. So the threat of not letting people get other work seems to keep coming up. But, you know, the idea that, like, why this person has committed murder is really dumb happens so much in this series. If you really start to pick it apart, it's like murder was the best you could come up with in this moment. Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what I thought, too, is that the method doesn't really fit the motive. Like, blowing someone up is pretty extreme.
Yeah.
And then his motive, Bert's motive, is like relatively minor. He's just trying to save his job. If someone was trying to get me fired, I'd murder them. I'm not going to murder anybody. But if someone was trying to get me fired and just from a theoretical kind of standpoint, I'd murder them like humanely, like with poison or a bullet or whatever. I'd save my bombs for someone who like killed my whole family or something. And when all I care about is revenge, because like a bomb is a statement. It gets a lot of press. You're going to get caught.
And, yeah, for
it's
sure.
It's got to be worth it, you know? So... this guy, I'm not sure. I get that, like, he stole it. He stole the bombs from the set. And it's like, how many bombs? All right, who's keeping track of these bombs? Like, because he can steal two without them going, or dynamite or whatever it is. Like, he can steal this much without, like, you know, somebody, like, figuring out or whatever. And then also, you know, how many people is he suddenly prepared to bomb? Like, you know, he's just going to bomb everybody. Like, whoever finds out, who gets close to, like, you know, his motive and figures him out. I mean, it seems like he is, like, I would assume this is his first killing. And to go straight to bombing is, like, pretty crazy. Like, you know, this is LA. You could probably get a gun within, like, you know, an hour or something.
Well, Mark, I guess he bombed at bombing, is what you're saying.
Pretty good.
So, yeah. No, I mean, you're right. As a director, I guess he wants a spectacle. But, yeah, it just seems like a last chance effort. I don't know. It just seems like a weird choice. I agree.
Yeah.
Also, why do we have actual bombs on the set? Like, I understand we actually have real firearms on sets.
Oh, gosh.
Right? We learned that during the Rust ordeal a few years ago. But, like... it's so dangerous and so weird. Like, just use fake stuff. Why on earth would you have a bomb? Like, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's Murder, She Wrote. It doesn't make sense a lot of the time. It doesn't matter.
A couple of things I just wanted to highlight in case we're finishing up soon is just one that I was a little surprised that the motive happened 20 minutes in. I don't always remember it taking quite that long, but I might just be misremembering. But that was a while. Sometimes it happens off camera and we never actually see it. It's happened before the episode has begun, or it happens at some point during the episode. But 20 minutes felt a little lengthy. And then just I was, one thing that we haven't really talked about is just like the racism that was also present. In addition to the sexism that they were trying to highlight can happen in Hollywood and in TV. And, they were sort of blatant with it, where Sid Sharkey has this idea for a new TV show called Undercover Urchins, which, the way he describes is just really awful. I wouldn't repeat it. And so, but, I think, in giving credit to Murder, She Wrote, they're trying to show that this is a bad person. This is the person who ends up being murdered. This isn't something we're saying is good about Hollywood, but still having it in there was a little surprising.
Yeah, for sure. But, this is something that I think in many ways it calls back to classic Murder, She Wrote, that although it did take a while for the murder to happen, as you said, and so it kind of at first it leaves us with a question of like, wait, which guy is going to get killed? Once you see how terrible Sid Sharkey is, it's like, oh, he's totally going to be the one who gets killed because that's what Murder, She Wrote does, right? It presents us these like white patriarchal guys, rich, powerful, and then like they're always the ones who get murdered, right? They're too evil for their own good.
Yes, or they turn out to be the murderer, maybe. And so then they're still going to get some form of justice. They're going to be thrown in jail and get caught, which then makes us happy about that too.
So, Alicia, you mentioned the inherent racism from his idea for Undercover Urchins, which is to have a multiracial cast of characters. But we also only have one person of color in this episode, which is our police officer. And we haven't talked about his relationship to Jessica through the investigation. And we should do that before we run out of time, because they have a pretty antagonistic relationship. And I'm wondering if you guys, what you guys felt of that, especially given that he is our only character of color.
Well, first of all, it's the great Yaphet Kotto. So, like, I was excited to see him in the cast list, like in the beginning, in the opening credits.
Some alien
And
fame.
exactly. And he just kind of like Angela Lansbury, like, he seems like a better, more authoritative actor than, most of the other actors here. And it's almost like when he arrives, it's like it's almost his show for a minute. It's just like because he's got so much kind of like presence and authority as an actor. But I was disappointed, given that I'm a fan of this actor, that I kind of felt like the script does him dirty, because it kind of makes him reckless and not a great detective. He kind of accuses everyone of murder except maybe the actual murderer. And he's kind of nowhere near solving the case until Lansbury kind of like teams up with them.
Well, that's typical oftentimes of the relationship sometimes between Lansbury and whoever's investigating, is that they definitely need her help.
I'm on board with that, but I'm less on board with like him just totally fumbling. He's like kind of the head of the department or something. He's the lead investigator, and I think he's like ready to arrest who's ever in front of him. It's really it plays a different way these days than it would like in the 80s. Like that just like given Alicia, like how we've seen like all these documentaries about like people who are accused and tried and were totally innocent. And so it's a little uncomfortable, say, for me. And that this is our one person of color. It's like, and it's the great Yaphet Kotto. It's like, like I think there could still be conflict and there could still be disagreement between them without it being like, he's not good at his job. And he's reckless and he's always angry. Like it could be, there could be a better dynamic that still has like, conflict. It's just like kind of they went to the, the most obvious place of like, oh, he's not very good at this. And oh, he's like, he's just not good at his job and also just kind of mean for no reason to like everyone. And that's, yeah, I don't know. So as much as I like to see him, this actor, I don't know. I don't know why he had to be a disagreeable person. And he kind of like smack talks her books. And I didn't like that. It was like, why would he just go to that like right away?
Oh,
And
it's
then,
delightful. I mean, he says, I read your books. It was a total waste of my time. Yeah,
well, so Bridget, what do you
amazing.
think? What does he mean by that? Because I was unclear. Like it seemed like really bad form and rude and stuff, but it also
People
seemed
are always saying stuff like that to Jessica, though, and she sort
okay.
of just takes it in stride, right? Like, she knows she's a talented writer, and who cares? Even if she's not talented, she's raking in the money. Like, the whole world thinks her books are great. So
But
I
would
think.
he, do you think, based on like your expanded knowledge of the show, like, and so this goes to both you, Bridget, and Alicia, like, do you think that he was saying that she doesn't write about crime realistically, or that she's just can't write a sentence? Like, I wasn't clear on
No,
that.
I think it's definitely like I think it's not the first time that we've seen law enforcement sort of
Okay.
bristle about the way that she writes about crime and solving
Okay.
crime, you know? I mean, but later he amends it later. He says, like, you might not be much of a writer, but you'd make a hell of a cop. So, like, he's sort of recognizing that her investigative skills
Yeah.
are on point, you know?
Yeah.
And I think we're supposed to see that as like him throwing a bone. I mean, Jessica certainly does, right? She's like, well, that is still kind of an insult, but
Yeah.
I will take it in the spirit you intended it, right?
Yeah.
And just Gail Yamada is also, you know, technically, I guess, a person of color as well. So we have two.
You're right. I should have mentioned that. She's Asian.
Yes. Yeah.
So, okay. So this is the part where we have to say our final thoughts. Like, do we recommend this episode? Is it among our favorites? Is it one of the ones that we think is, wow, we needed 22 episodes to fill a season and it's skippable on a rewatch? What do you think? We'll start with Mark.
All right, well, I've said a lot of it. I've said, yeah, I wish they'd handled Yaphet Kotto's character in a different way. And like you guys have said, that it's a low key kind of like motive. And the motive for me doesn't really fit this bombing method, which is, you know, seems so extreme. I would say that the opening, like I mentioned, the opening's really strong. And as you guys have said too, the closing, the climax of the story where the cops descend, you know, on the director, like that's really well done and strong. And like just Angela Lansbury's presence is really strong. And she, I like how she tries to help Gail's writing career and also how she kind of, you know, politely schools Dr. Danger's girlfriend for being his lackey. So there's like a lot of strong stuff. But what I wrote down is that the episode is like a suitcase's worth of stuff crammed into a messenger's bag. There are so many characters, so much plot, so much to track, and it does feel rushed and jammed together to fit this time frame. And it feels assembled, a lot of it, as opposed to directed, except with that really strong opening and then the climactic reveal with the cops and stuff. So I would say no. I would say this is like, you know, I don't regret watching it, but I would say it's not
Not one
like
of your
a,
favorites.
yeah, I don't think it's a particularly strong episode, even though, you know, it's got some strengths, obviously.
Okay, Alicia, what about you? Is this a keeper on rewatch or do we skip it?
I love the meta aspect of it. I love the how personal it is to the show itself, but overall, I did find it to be a bit of a disappointment, this particular episode.
They're nuts. I love this episode. I think it's so much fun. And I think it's just fun also for me because it's like it's all the repeat Murder, She Wrote guest stars doing something different this time. Although Ken Swofford getting murdered is like, yeah, feels like he should get murdered. He always plays bad guys. I'm just disappointed that Bradford Dillman wasn't our bad guy because it seems like he should be the bad guy.
Oh,
But
I wrote that down too. Yeah, it's like the murderer is a better person than the guy who got killed. Like,
yeah.
you know, so that's
Right.
interesting. Yeah.
I think that's about it for today. Thank you to Alicia Schaefer and Mark Benedict for joining me. I'm Bridget Keys, and we'll be back next week. The Cabot Cove Gazette's theme song is Reaching the Sky by Alexander Nakarada, used under Creative Commons license. You can find us on social media. We're Cabot Cove Gazette on Facebook and @Cove Gazette on Instagram and Twitter.